I do appreciate that. I chose to do the whole reading because I think we need to see the whole the thing in context, and so we have the whole suite of chapter one. We're continuing this morning in our series for the summer on women in the Bible, and as you gather, thinking there a little bit about Hannah. But before that, I want you to indulge me in a little digression. I want to take you back to the 31st of December, 1960. Hard luck if that doesn't apply. Anyway, it was a Tuesday, and I was 8 years old. Of course, I have no specific memory of that day, except Tuesday was the day that this weekly comic was I did not take this publication regularly, but it has stuck in my memory for the last 57 years. And I've not seen a copy of it in that time until a couple of weeks ago when I was fishing around on the internet, and lo and behold, I found a rather hazy image of the very same copy. Grainy, I'm afraid, but that was the publication that I have remembered all these years. Now, the thing that struck me, and indeed grabbed the fascination of my 8-year-old self, was the fact that it was New Year's Eve. And so the next day would begin 1961. And what this front page pointed out was that 1961 reads the same. Upside down, or the right way up. Now, of course, I'm sure that you're all very familiar with strobogrammatic numbers. But that is indeed what numbers such as this are called. So, 1961, if we tip it round, ends up up there. Here we go, 1961. The Beatles haven't yet made it in the big time, and it's another 2 years before their first number one. The same phenomenon occurred 80 years earlier, in 1881, when Queen Victoria was on the throne and was looking as unamused as ever. And then you have to go back another 190 years to 1691 for it to happen again, the days of the Spanish Inquisition. I bet no one expected that. And so, the further back you go, you can find these numbers just occasionally popping up. Right back, indeed, to the year naught, which is in itself strobogrammatic. Perhaps the rather special thing, though, about 1961 was, and still is that if you want to see this again, the next time this upside-down thing of a year happens, well, you've got a very long wait. In fact, you've got to stick around for the next 3,992 years until 6,009. The 18th of August, 1981, is the birthday of my son, now 36 years old, or will be next week. And so if you write his birthday like this, okay, 81. That is strobogrammatic, but also palindromic. See? Special stuff. Which is a very, very tenuous way of getting to Anna. It's also palindromic. There's just a remote possibility that this will have some relevance to Hannah's story. But to begin with, let's just note then that she herself is a palindrome. The story of Hannah occurs in the time of the Judges, not too far removed from the time of Ruth and Naomi, whose stories we've already heard in this series. It's generally understood then that the author of Judges was Samuel, same Samuel whose birth we've been thinking about in the story this morning. He became a key figure in the transition of Israel to become a monarchy. He became Israel's kingmaker, first Saul and then, of course, David. But that's all running on a little bit, so let's go back to the time when Samuel was not even a glint in his father's eye. The biblical narrative seems to be strewn with examples of babies born to women who were unlikely to become mothers. Hannah is one of them. And as the story begins, we find a forlorn character unable to conceive and living in misery as a result. The Christian writer Jeff Lucas comments as this. In Hannah's era, barrenness meant even more than the crushing despair experienced by childless couples today. Childlessness brought acute social stigma as well. The popular belief was that childless couples were being punished for offending the gods who controlled reproduction. In Israel, children were thought of to be a sign of the blessing of God. And so barrenness was a sign of divine displeasure, his curse. Like a rain cloud that would never shift, heartache and shame had hung over Hannah for years. Now, Hannah's situation was made worse by the circumstances of her marriage. Her husband, Elkanah, who was a godly man, and the husband of two wives. Mind you, given the circumstances, he must have begun to wonder about the wisdom of polygamy. His other wife was the all-too-fertile Peninnah. Peninnah had children, and it seems revelled in the fact, taking every opportunity to belittle Hannah and harshly ridicule her barrenness. Now, this grim situation went on year after year, and it was especially acute when the family made their annual pilgrimage to sacrifice at Shiloh. Elkanah loved his wives, but was especially fond of Hannah, something that probably didn't escape the notice of Peninnah, and also fueled her animosity towards her rival. So let's not be in any doubt, this is a serious situation. Hannah is desolate with grief and despair over her unending predicament, and yet another angst-ridden, tearful trip to Shiloh is imminent. And at this point, we can make an observation about this lady. Even after years of waiting for a child and shouldering the heavy burden of her barrenness, she still prays to God. What else could she do? Well, it is suggested that she might have succumbed to the temptation of appealing to the pagan deities of her day, which would have involved her in giving them her devotion and following whatever fertility rites worship of them demanded. But Hannah holds firm, despite the lack of answer to her prayers. She maintains her faith in God, constantly returning to her petition. Trusting in faith that God would hear. Now, unlike Tony, it's August and Chris and I haven't been invited to a single wedding this year. Whereas in 2016, we went to five weddings. And all of those who are married in church express that it is their will to agree to the following church. Will you love him, comfort him, honour and protect him, forsaking all others, be faithful to him as long as you both shall live. And when it comes to the solemn vows, promise, from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and cherish till death us do. Being faithful as long as we live. Forsaking all others. Better, for worse. In many ways, Hannah's chosen path through her troubles reflects these deep and profound words. Even when it seems hopeless and God seems not to be responding to her prayers, she hangs on in there. And this is a woman of faith. It reminds me of another pretty hopeless situation faced by three men of God, far away from home, faced with the prospect of death if they refused to break their faith in God. Wind the clock forward 500 years from Hannah, and we find the Jews are in exile in Babylon. The Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, sets himself up as God and created a mighty statue that all were required to bow down to and worship. The penalty that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego faced was being burned alive in a fiery furnace. Not very sure what other kind of furnace you can get, but be assured this was really fiery.
Well, the king says, there it is, lads. Bow down to my statue, or else you face the char-grilled consequences. And we read, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand, as indeed he does. And then this, but even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Forsaking all others, be faithful to him as long as you both shall live. To say we have faith is one thing, to truly live and even die by it is quite another. And this is the sort of woman we see in Hannah. A woman who would echo the words of the psalmist. Whoever dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom I trust. But even in her steadfast faith, she is still human. And we read that she wept and would not eat. And in deep anguish, Hannah prayed to the Lord, weeping bitterly. And then, after years of this heartfelt, faith-grounded praying, something changes. The family are once again at Shiloh, and we read, once when they'd finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. I've struggled to find a commentator who addresses that comment, Hannah stood up. But to my mind, it signals a deep-seated and fundamental change in her. Her prayer now takes a different tack. She has perhaps reached the end of her resources and stands empty before God, casting herself wholly upon his grace and mercy. And she made a vow, saying, Lord Almighty, if you will only look on your servant's misery and remember me and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord for all of the days of his life. It seems that Hannah has chosen to abandon any shred of selfish desire to have a child, preferring to fully commit her cause to God and saying, not my will, but yours be done. If you will give me a child, then I will willingly surrender him back to you. Following this, we read, then she went her way and ate something, and her face was no longer downcast. Hannah has changed. Every one of us who has encountered the living God in our lives can testify to this business of change. Change is what God does in people's lives. The outcome is that we cease to be who we were and we begin again in a very different way. Hannah perhaps comes to the point where she is resigned and relieved to put it all in God's hands, whatever the outcome. And the change is significant. Her behaviour changes, as does her physical appearance, and she returns home at peace, ready to live life surrendered and committed to God. Even then, though, we note that change is an ongoing process, for we're told that in the course of time, Hannah becomes pregnant. Samuel is born, and when old enough, is dedicated to God to live at and serve in Shiloh with Eli the priest. It must be just a tad irritating to some of you who've not been to New Wine to hear people keep rabbiting on about it, but perhaps that just indicates that it's worth a look. But Chris and I went to New Wine just for a couple of days on week two, and I too heard a talk by John Mark Comer in which he spoke about the gap between dream and reality. His talk focused on the story of Joseph, but equally applied more widely, including, in his words, Hannah. The speaker identified four characteristics of the progression from the time of initial dream to its fulfillment. In Joseph's case, the dream was in fact a dream, but John Mark expressed the notion of the same ideas apply when we begin to pursue with God a sense of prompting or a desire or a dream. So in the context of our thinking about Hannah, I share his words with you this morning. This gap then between the dream and reality. The first thing he mentioned was, it'll be different. Hannah wanted a baby and she longed for it so that she might have a channel for her maternal love, acceptance and approval from her culture and community, equality with Peninnah, and perhaps delight to share with her loving husband. And as we know, though, Hannah's dream of having a baby didn't work out quite like that. Although she did eventually have a baby, the events, circumstances, and outcome were rather different from those that she probably imagined when she first got married. Secondly, he observed that the pathway is harder. Both Joseph and Hannah, their pathway that they had to tread was a great deal harder than they would have imagined or desired. Joseph, remember, suffered for years, experiencing injustice, slavery, hardship, false accusation, and imprisonment along the way. And as we know, poor Hannah shouldered that pain of infertility, the misery of Peninnah's jibes, the well-meant but clumsily unhelpful support of her husband, along with the wider judgment, social judgment and disgrace, a much harder path than she'd have chosen or thought of, perhaps, when she looked ahead to a happy family life with Elkanah. His next point was the pathway is often longer. Now, we live at a time when much of what we want and expect in life comes very quickly or even faster. I was reminded about my childhood experience of photography. This is my first camera. I don't know whether anybody else had one of these. Kodak Brownie 127. Strange things that one's parents decide to preserve and then squirrel away in their cupboards for their adult children to discover when finally clearing their homes. This camera took 8 black and white pictures. And each one was very precious. And once the film was exposed, it had to be taken down to the local chemist, where it was sent away for processing. Sometime later, and for a child, it really was a very long wait, the prints would be collected from the same chemist and taken home for the thrill of examination. Today, on our phones, we take hundreds of instant, high-quality colour images to which we give little thought, and they either clog up our storage or we print them off ourselves at home, or we simply discard and delete them. The waiting is taken out of wanting. But for Hannah and Joseph and many others too, the wait is a long one, running into years. John Mark's final point, though, was that the outcome is often better than we'd have imagined. The final one, then, is a rather more cheerful analysis of this gap between dream and reality. Joseph, you remember, he rises to responsibility, power, and influence second only to Pharaoh. In her prayer of response to God and his goodness, we find in 1 Samuel chapter 2, Hannah says this: "My heart rejoices in the Lord. In the Lord my horn is lifted high. There is no one holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God." Then, "But those who were hungry are hungry no more. She who was barren has borne seven children, but she who has had many sons pines away." This song of praise to God is reflected in the Magnificat, the record in Luke's gospel of Mary's response to the news of another unexpected baby. Scholars do not feel it is to be interpreted literally, and thus we do not know that Hannah went on to have six more children. But the point is, she rejoices in God's goodness to her, and however many more children she did or didn't have, she is content and fulfilled. Number seven is an expression of completeness. In the years of her agony, Hannah could never have imagined speaking of life and experience in this way, in such terms. God's sense of time and timing quite often seems to be at odds with our human ideas. Our modern world experience of instant gratification means that we struggle to be at ease with waiting. Just last week, if you were here, Julie shared with us the experience of her daughter's 14-year wait for a job. Moses, he waited for decades. Jacob, he had to wait 7 years and then another 7 years. Perhaps the long periods of time between those strobogrammatic dates reflects this business of time. Not to mention the 3,992 years, it's 4,048 from 61 to 6,009. I got to thinking about Hannah, by the way, being a palindrome. But Hannah like this actually isn't truly palindromic. But if we drop the capital letter, it is. Perhaps the change in Hannah that we observed is reflected in this. With the capital letter, Hannah is who she is. It is her name. And names, of course, must start with a capital letter. To lose the capital diminishes the ownership of the name, and the owner relinquishes their sense of self-importance. Only when Hannah did this before God was she at peace. And it was following this that everything changed. Hannah prays to God. God gives her peace. Hannah waits. God blesses her with a baby Samuel. Hannah rejoices and releases her precious son serve God for the rest of his life. This sense of back and forth perhaps reflects that forward and backward flow of the palindrome. It would be foolish and cruelly insensitive to suggest that we view lightly the pain of childlessness today. We don't interpret scripture frivolously and suggest that all you have to do is do what Hannah did and bingo, everything will be fine. So what are we to take away from this lady who lived and died so long ago? Firstly, her faith in God. Persevering, holding on, standing firm, trusting God for the long haul, and finding the depth of faith that says, well, even if he doesn't. Expect change. As we encounter God and endure in our relationship with him and pursue our pathway through life in his close and reassuring company, we would expect to change. And walk in our relationship and partnership with God as we traverse that gap between the dream and the reality. The road may be harder and longer than we might want, and the outcome almost certainly different. But by God's grace, better than we might have ever planned or imagined.